From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. I was there when it all went down. Well, how many times have you heard that? Perhaps you were there when something happened or somebody famous was close by. Mine was years ago. I was at a party on the Gold Coast, and the house where the party was the next door neighbours to Ugly Dave Gray. But he wasn't home. So that was my touch with fame. Anyway, today I was there in Monza in 1971 at the Italian Grand Prix when... and find out. And late in August, it was World Ambulance Day, so we better have a quick look at that as well. And we had a piece last week about electric vehicles in New Zealand and the steps they're taking. This week, we thought you'd bring you up to date with what's not happening in Australia as far as EVs are concerned. Come on, guys, we've got to get behind this electric vehicles. It's the future, and we're all about the future. And the past in 30 laps. Okay, but let's start with World Ambulance Day, shall we? From drive.com.au, the Sydney Morning Herald of the 21st of August, Rob Margit writes, "Who knew there is an internationally recognised day acknowledging the contribution to society of our paramedics?" Well, there is, and it's today, which was the 21st of August, the International Day of Medical Transporters. To celebrate, we've thrown together a little gallery of some of the cooler and or weirder ambulances from around the world. The word ambulance is derived from the Latin ambulare, meaning to walk or move about. The first recorded use of ambulances dates back to 1487, when the Spanish army moved casualties during the Siege of Malaga, although there is evidence of medical transportation dating back to 900 AD. The St John's Ambulance Service started life in 1887 in Dublin, Ireland. The first motorised ambulance went into service in 1899 for the Michael Reese Hospital in Chicago. The first dedicated, mass-produced, car-based ambulance, as opposed to a vehicle that had been adapted for that purpose, was built by James Cunningham and Son in New York, named the Model 774 Automobile Ambulance. It had a 24-kilowatt four-cylinder engine. Inside, patients were transported on a suspended cot with seating for two attendants, aka ambos. The reason a lot of ambulances feature the word encanubla on the front of their vehicles is so drivers can see the word the right way round in their rearview mirrors. So, happy International Day of Medical Transporters, and thanks to all the hard-working ambos and paramedics for all the work that they do. You men and women and the ambulance corps, you rock. Well, ain't superstitious and I don't get suspicious, but my woman is a friend of mine, and I know that it's true. That is for sure. Now, what happened in 1971 at the Italian Grand Prix? Let's go to Motorsport magazine and find out. The scene of a mesmerising lead battle that ended in one of the Formula One's closest ever finishes. Nigel Roebuck recounts the 1971 Italian Grand Prix in Monza. And this originally appeared in the magazine September 2nd, 2013. As hard as it may to believe now, time was when there were no chicanes at Monza, when the track, prior to 1972, was uncompromisingly fast. You had the Curva Grande and the two Lesmos, which were really testing corners, said Jackie Stewart. But for most of the lap, you were flat out. Back then, the feeling was, like Monaco, it still had a place in the calendar as a maverick event. Although even 40 years ago, before safety had become the overriding issue it is today, Monza was considered perilous. When the drivers arrived there in September 1971, there was nothing save a Grand Prix victory at stake. At the Ostering 3 weeks earlier, Stewart had clinched his second world championship. Such had been his domination with the Tyrrell that, with Monza, Mosport and Watkins Glen still to be run, he was beyond reach. The season was my first as a racing journalist, and in the course of it I got to know most of the drivers, in particular Chris Amon, who had a natural ability to throw away, and time again led Grand Prix comfortably, only for something on his car to fail. I might say that Chris is a particular friend of 30 laps with Dick, and we've featured him once or twice. In 1971, however, we'll go back to the story. Sorry, Nigel. In 1971, Amon was with Matra, whose chassis was as good as any in the business, but propelled by a shrieking V12 engine, way less powerful than it sounded. Indeed, so pathetic had it been at the Nürburgring that the team decided to pass up the Austrian Grand Prix and concentrate on resolving the problem, which centred around the oil system. It worked too, said Chris. Everyone thought we had a new engine, but we hadn't. They'd simply solved the oil churning problem. When they put my new ring engine on the dyno, they found it was giving only 395 brake horse. But the one they gave me for Monza had 460, which was on par with the Cosworth, if not Ferrari, and the best of the BRM engines. Having recently hit a period of reliability, BRM looked in good shape. After the death of Pedro Rodriguez in a minor sports car race in July, Joe Seffert had truly stepped up to the plate, and he won at Ostering, another quick track. Monza was expected to favour the V12s, with the Cosworth V8s runners for once up against it. In those less official times, to penalise a Ferrari at Monza would have been unthinkable. There were fewer spectators than usual for the practice days, perhaps because the championship was already settled in the favour of Stewart, rather than Jackie X. For the sake of the race day crowd, clearly the organisers hoped for a Ferrari driver on pole. In those days, timekeeping was a somewhat haphazard business. There were no TV screens showing instant order changes, no automatic timing system. And at Monza, there were 6 hours of practice, all official, all counting for grid positions. After each session, you waited endlessly for the sheets to be issued. Late on Saturday afternoon, X and Ferrari were shown as fastest, and the Italian journalist duly went to work on suitably enthusiastic stories. Only after the papers had gone to press did Michel Dubois, Matra's unimpeachable, impregnable timekeeper, who was able to persuade the authorities that someone had set a quicker time than X, half a second quicker, in fact. All through practice, when I was running on my own, I was lapping nearly a second quicker than anyone else, said Amon, and I got pole quite easily. As well as that, X's time was cooked, I think. When the crowd arrived on Sunday morning, it was thus with some disappointment, that they learned the blue car, rather than the red, would be starting from pole. They said they were much soothed when Clay Regazzoni's Ferrari, starting from the front road, made the best start. Consummately the best. By the time the rest got moving, Clay was already in second gear, but in those less official times, to penalise a Ferrari at Monza, particularly one driven by previous year's winner, would have been unthinkable. At the end of the opening lap, Regazzoni swept by with a sizeable lead and the crowd went nuts. In the early laps, though, most of the leading was done by Pedersen's march. Ronnie, that's Ronnie Pedersen, hounded by the Tyrrells of Stewart and Francis Severt's BRM and Regazzoni and X. At Monza, the attrition rate is always high. And by lap 18, Stewart was gone, together with both Ferraris. But so mesmerised was the lead battle that the locals, rather than head for the car park, stayed put. Seffert was the next man in trouble. His BRM jammed in fourth gear, and by now others were coming through, notably Mike Hailwood, who had not driven a Formula One car for 6 years and was making a return with his Surtees team. On lap 25, Hailwood, who qualified 17th, came by in the lead. "I didn't know this sleep-streaming lark was all about," he grinned afterwards. "I'd never done it before." Late into the laps, the front runners shook themselves down, preparing for the sprint to the flag. It was all a matter of being in the right place at the right time at the Parabolica and getting through well by slip-streaming by the rest just before the line. The last thing a thinking driver wanted to do was lead into the last corner on the last lap. As it was, Severt and Pedersen arrived virtually side by side, both leaving their braking too late, both sliding a little wide, at which point Peter Gethin's BRM, fourth at the start of the last lap, dived past the pair of them and held the lead all the way to the flag. The rev limiter was on 10,500, Peter laughed afterwards, but I took it to 11.5 before snatching top gear, figuring that the bugger would probably blow apart, but if it didn't, I'd win. Over the line, Gethin, who somehow found the time and confidence to give a victory salute, was a couple of feet ahead of Pedersen with Severt third, Hailwood fourth, Howden Ganley fifth for BRM, was 6/10 behind Gethin. Half a minute later, Amon trailed in sixth. I got a pretty poor start and the temperature started to go up a bit, so I just sat back and waited until I'd got rid of that bit of fuel. Once I'd done that, I had no trouble in getting up to the front. I led for several laps without any problem, but 9 laps from the end when I lost my visor. In previous races I'd been using tear-offs, so this time I taped it on more firmly, too firmly as it turned out, because when I pulled it off, the whole bloody visor came off with it. Actually, Chris mused, it wouldn't have made a lot of difference, because then I started to get fuel starvation as well. It's a bit disappointing, all in all. At races in the United States, they love to reel off statistics. The number of leaders, the number of lead changes, the laps led, and so on. But this has never caught on in Europe, perhaps for the sound reason that lead changes are not something to be taken for granted in Formula One. At Monza that day, there were 25 lead changes among 8 drivers. But maybe the most numbing fact of all was that there were only 8 of the 55 laps was the order, as it had been, the previous time round. And although Gethin never won another world championship race, his name may well be in the record books for all time as winner of the fastest Grand Prix ever run, 150.754 miles an hour. That's at Monza, of course. After 1971, there were changes. When the teams went back a year later, chicane blight had ravaged the place, fundamentally changing its character and breaking the pack, cutting the lead lap by 20 mile an hour. Once again, Amon and X shared the front row, but neither finished, and the Lotus of Emerson Fittipaldi won comfortably from Hailwood's Surtees. "A better result than last year," Mike observed, "but no fun at all. They've ruined the track with these poxy chicanes." Not sure what he would make of Formula One in the 21st century. As a footnote, poor Mike was killed not long after that race on a private road. Anyhow, I was there when... in the 1971 Italian Grand Prix from Motorsport magazine, originally posted September 2nd, 2013, written by Nigel Roebuck. Could say Mr. Gethin was flying like an eagle. So now we move back to EV cars that we had a look at last week, and we look at the Australian perspective from Neil Dowling from the Go Auto News, written 26th of August this year, 2020. What's he got to say? Australia's Electric Vehicle Council, the EVC, has handed down a damning F rating for the federal government and some other states and territories in its annual State of Electric Vehicles report released last week, highlighting the fact that several jurisdictions continue to avoid introducing emissions policy based on electrified transport system. Developing a new policy scorecard to rate governments against a range of effective and evidence-backed policies to encourage and support electric vehicle uptake, the EVC said it found a continued reluctance, most apparent at the federal level, to proactively position Australia's transport sector to benefit from electrification. On a positive note, however, the Council said various EV strategies were under development and that it was hopeful many could be implemented, with some states and territories making policy announcements but still some distance from introducing measures. The EVC has scored each jurisdiction on its level of progress with implementation and said it expected significant improvements by some states over the next 12 months in these many policy areas. It said that in 2020, the ACT government was the clear leader, receiving a B mark, and was closely followed by New South Wales and Queensland, both with a C. Victoria and South Australia rated a D, while Western Australia, the Northern Territory, copped an F, the lowest rating, as the federal government. According to the Council, New South Wales has made the most progress over the past year in advancing EV policies, bringing the state up to the level of progress already made by the ACT and Queensland governments. New South Wales recently announced commitments to further invest in public charging networks, provide co-funding for fleets to transition to electric vehicles, and electrify Sydney's bus fleet, the EVC report said. The Queensland government has continued to implement the Future is Electric, Queensland Electric Vehicle Strategy, and invest in public charging infrastructure along its electric superhighway. The ACT is progressing on meeting its strong targets to electrify its own fleet, including its bus fleet, and has committed to making its buildings ready for EVs. The EVC said that Victoria, South Australia, WA and Northern Territory have EV strategies ready for release this calendar year, so we expect these states to start implementing more electric vehicle policies over the next 12 months. And that was Joshua Dowling's piece on the state of electric vehicles in Australia state by state, and it was from drive.com, which is part of the Sydney Morning Herald motoring section, on the 31st of August. And we're staying with all things electric, and we're staying with drive.com from the Sydney Morning Herald, and we're actually staying with Joshua Dowling, so that's a hat trick. But anyway, he writes in the paper last week, a Tesla driver using an autopilot has admitted to watching a movie on his phone as his car crashed into two police vehicles that were stopped on the side of the road. The incident occurred in Nash County, North Carolina, last week when two police cars were responding to an earlier crash. The Tesla ploughed into one police car, which was then pushed into the other police car and struck the officers at the scene. However, according to CBS, no injuries were reported. The highway patrol said the Tesla driver said he was watching a movie on his phone while the car was in autopilot when the collision occurred. Thankfully, no one was injured. The trooper, Jeff Wilson of the Highway Patrol, told CBS. It was a simple lane closure, and then suddenly death was at our footstep. I think that's what he meant. Nash County Sheriff Keith Stone told the CBS. Authorities said the crash showed autonomous car technology is never going to take the place of the motoring public paying attention, not texting, not being on the phone, but focusing on driving. This is the second Tesla being driven on autopilot to crash into a police car in the United States in the past 2 months. In July, an Arizona police car was hit by a Tesla on autopilot. Last year, the head of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, the IIHS, in the US, said the name of autonomous car technology has implications for what a driver understands. The 2019 survey by the IIHS found the name autopilot can create misconceptions. Almost half of the survey respondents indicated they would take their hands off the steering wheel, and almost 6% thought they could take a nap while the system was in autopilot, the IIHS said. Crikey. Well, that little piece was from Joshua Dowling about the scary stuff on autopilot from the Sydney Morning Herald Drive magazine. It's probably safer to fly. Thank you, Mr. Steve Miller from the Steve Miller Band. Or there's that old joke running around in British politics that some prefer his older brother, Ed Miller Band. Anyway, moving on. And we spoke last week about the very first electric car, so I thought we'd better have stick a couple more in while we've still got the opportunity. How about the Panhard of 1891? This comes from Autocar, the Teslas of Time, Innovators of History by Ronan Glenn. Okay, he's probably had that joke a few times. Anyway, Panhard took its first steps in the automotive industry by purchasing a license to build two-cylinder engines from Daimler, led by Emile Levasseur and René Panhard, two accomplished engineers. The French company quickly began making its own power cars, powered by engines designed in-house. Panhard's vehicle won several endurance races in the 1890s and the 1900s, but the firm quit racing in 1908, in the wake of several deadly accidents. It then focused largely on innovation and notably released its first valveless engine in 1910. After World War II, Panhard began selling more accessible cars in order to stay afloat. Few people could afford the quick, luxurious machines it had made before the start of the war. It nonetheless continued innovating by making its cars highly aerodynamic and by using lightweight materials, like aluminium, to keep fuel economy in check. It didn't have the resources to update or expand its lineup as often as its rivals, and it fell into dire financial straits around the turn of the 1960s. It was taken over by Citroën in 1965 and closed 2 years later. Now, these vehicles and manufacturers aren't necessarily electric, they're just innovators. I should have made that point a bit clearer before I started, folks, but now I have. Are you still with me? Let's go to Volvo in 1927. While Volvo's first car wasn't a beacon of innovation, the company began seriously looking towards the future when it released the PV36 in 1935. It was more aerodynamic than most cars made by rival manufacturers because its headlights were integrated into the body and its rear wheels were covered. At the time, motorists didn't like the look, and they argued the PV36, which was nicknamed Carioca, was heavy, underpowered, and expensive. Volvo consequently made only 500 before pulling the plug on the project. The problems encountered by the PV36 did not discourage Volvo from experimenting with new ideas. It notably introduced a three-point seatbelt in 1959 and later waived its patent rights so that other automakers could add the feature to their cars without paying royalty fees. Seatbelt use was controversial at the time and many drivers refused to wear one, but Volvo pressed forward. In 2019, no company would dare consider selling a car without a three-point seatbelt. That's what I like about Volvo. What a great gesture, hey? That wasn't the last two. They made several interesting innovations in their vehicles, and they continue to be very safe, which is sensibly all one should have, or one of the major things one should have when looking at a new motor car. How safe is it? We'll be having a look at Volvo as a manufacturer in the weeks to come. It's an interesting story, and it's inspiring. It's inspiring to read about a car maker that makes a car in a country that is driving itself in the winter is sometimes very hazardous indeed. Thanks for your company today. I hope you've enjoyed our little trip around Monza before they screwed it up, made it slower, and our EVs and our ambulances. I look forward to your company next week when we'll be talking about something completely different, I guess. But thank you so much for taking the time to listen. We'll talk again soon. Bye for now.